So look, it's wonderful to be here in your house, Veronica. I know other people call you Ronnie. I don't know. I don't really want to be overly familiar.
No, I go by Ronnie.
Do you go by Ronnie?
I tell you why. My father and Stephen today, he used to come in to wake us up with some children, and he used to sing to me. He said, the Ron, the king of all birds, on St. Stephen's Day got caught in the forest. And I always went by Ronnie after that.
That's amazing, because the Ran, but the Ron, the Ron.
The Ron, the king of all birds.
Was your dad a nice man? Did you have a good relationship with him?
He was adorable.
I'm Iarla Olinard, and this is Vocal Chords, the story of a life in song. Today, my guest is a singer perhaps more famous for her gift of discovering and nurturing outstanding operatic voices. Veronica Dunn, or Ronnie as everyone knows her, chose opera over her other love, horses, when she was very young, and at 18, headed off to Rome to study bel canto. A glittering career began, which saw her play Puccini's Mimi in Covent Garden. She crossed paths with the great divas of the day, including Maria Callas and Joan Sutherland. And when she left the stage in the 60s, she dedicated her life to teaching. For over half a century, Ronnie has been the force behind a legion of singers coming from Ireland, including Miriam Murphy, Anthony Kearns, Celine Byrne, and Tara Erocht. And you, like you've said before, that your father was able to sing, your brother was able to sing, your sister was able to sing, and that there was singing as a sort of a normal carry-on in the house.
Yeah, it was, yeah. My mother did some sort of singing, but Daddy and his family, there were four or five boys, and they all sang. Baritone, tenor, and it was unbelievable at Christmas, you know, our parties. They've gone now, those lovely parties. And I've often seen a photograph of the children sitting on the stairs in their nightgown. And that was just my sister and myself.
You'd be sitting down listening to others as a young child.
Like the stairs would be there and the drawing room would be here, you know, and we'd see all the people in there sitting down, you know. And we'd be sitting on the stairs listening to them.
Do you remember the kind of song, say, that your dad might have
called? Oh, The Heart Bowed Down. And Mauritana. Bald songs, and then they would sing in English, of course, the flower song from Carmen, and then the Toreador. They'd go through them all, the men would, and the women were the same.
And was there a piano in the house?
Yeah, there was a piano in the house, yeah.
And was there a gramophone?
Yeah, we had a gramophone.
And yeah. So there was stuff to listen to as well?
Yes, there was, yeah.
So you were exposed to this very young. I've heard you say that your own sister was a good singer too.
Yeah, my sister sang as well. My brother won the O'Mara Cup, and my sister won the Operatic Cup. Loud sang the lark o'er fields of gold,
high in the heavens above. What was the state of opera in Dublin, as a cultural thing, in those years?
Well, there was the Dublin Opera Society and then the Dublin Grand Opera Society. The Dublin Opera Society did Olympia Theatre and the Dublin Grand did the Grafton Theatre.
And And do you remember those performances around that period?
I remember as a child going to the Olympia because that was the first one. And then they had a row and they started another company. And that was where I got involved with the second company. But I remember going as a child to the operas with my father and mother.
Now, there was a moment, as I understand it, where you were actually invited to sing.
Because we used to go to Sligo. I did. My cousin lived there. And I'd go for the whole summer. And hopefully I'd come back speaking Irish, which I didn't. I'm sorry.
You don't have to apologise to me.
So they didn't know I could sing. Mm. But they taught me the Hills of Donegal. And they were singing. I was there in my party dress, looking at everybody. And my brother said, Bill said, get up and sing. So I got up and I sang the Hills of Donegal. And at that time, my brother and my sister were going to Hubert Rooney. Mm. And he was doing very well with Hubert Rooney, and my sister was doing well. And Bill turned around and he said, look, my God, she's a great voice. It's a strong voice. So I'm bringing you into Hubert. And this was at 11 years of age.
Then that was your first pathway into sort of learning a specific type of singing. That's known, I think, as the repetiteur sort of. He was the accompanist. He had the skill to draw out a voice.
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of a man was he?
He was a very religious man, a very good man. And, like, I just did the technique and did all the scales, and then he got me onto breathing lessons. And then I went to boarding school, and I could only go on a Thursday to him. So I kept that up.
And people cite the term bel canto quite a lot when they ascribe a sort of musical philosophy to you. Mm. Was that your teacher's philosophy? Was that his approach?
My teacher had altered. You, Johnny, I can tell you, he was the man who taught me a very good technique.
Right.
And I absorbed it.
Can you even describe some aspects of that technique?
Well, if you were learning, for instance, a song, you sang only on vowels. And he did a lot of anatomy with me to realise the tongue was very important. You never pulled the tongue back down your neck. And he talked, he said, now, this is what happens when you sing. I'd say, yes. And then he said, you don't go out of your body with the breath. Make you aware of your diaphragm and you feel comfortable. And he was into a lot of yawning so that you were widened and that these muscles here would spread out. Now, if you put your hand on my muscles, come on.
Okay, I'm doing that now. Oh, I see. They expand quite a bit. Wow. Very impressive muscles.
Yes. So then when you get top notes, you have to have a bigger space.
So there was an amount of almost philosophy about the body as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I came along and I was getting stronger and stronger and stronger.
When you say your voice was getting stronger, you were growing from 11 into young womanhood. Could you feel that in yourself?
Well, the voice was getting stronger, but so was I.
So were you. Yes.
You know, I used to do a lot of hunting. Mm.
You were strong, yeah. But also you could hear the voice.
I could hear the voice of everything else. But he would never let me do the flesh.
Why so?
He said, I don't want anybody to beat Veronica Dunn.
And how did you feel about that?
I didn't mind.
You didn't mind?
I didn't mind. I'd do anything.
So it might be paradoxical to some people to hear that because, I mean, you prepare people now and have done, and you yourself, competition is so much a part of the culture of the classical operatic voice.
Yeah.
But in your early days, you were somehow insulated from that.
Yeah, I was protected.
Why would that have been a good thing, do you think, or was it?
Well, a good thing in the sense that I was very shy when I was singing. And I think if I was up against bitches, excuse my language,
it might have crushed you.
Yeah.
So he
changed my course.
Was that a sign of his great perceptual understanding of you as well, that he saw this?
Mm.
And he thought, I'm not going to let this happen to this young lady now. Yeah. I'm going to build her up.
You protect her.
And, I mean, obviously he also probably coached you on sight reading, and but did he also sort of talk about the various sub-styles or sub-categories of the operatic voice, like the different traditions?
Well, he knew that I was a young child, a young girl.
Yes.
And then I was interested in other things as well, you know.
Yes.
And he didn't interfere with that.
And how many years did you stay with him?
I was with him until I went to Rome, 18, going on 19.
You wanted to go to Rome?
Well, he spoke about the wonderful singers in France, in Europe.
Hmm.
He was a European, really.
Yes.
And he wanted to... he actually wanted to come with me. But he was too old, the poor man.
And at what point did you think, A, I have to leave Ireland, or I want to leave Ireland to go somewhere else to expand?
Oh, I always had that in my mind.
You always had that?
Always had that in my mind.
Where did that thought come from?
Well, listening to Margaret Brooke Sheridan. She had a wonderful voice.
And was this on radio?
No, it was on records.
On records?
Yeah.
So when you heard her, you felt inspired to...
Oh, absolutely. And when the war came and she came back to Ireland, she used to walk down Grafton Street and I would walk behind her. I was fascinated by her. She'd walk this way. And she still thinks she was on stage.
How would you describe her voice?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. I think she went out too soon. I think I went out too soon too, but whatever. She was, look, that woman sang for Puccini, Leoncavallo. When music was blossoming, was another era, you know? And of course they would have loved her. She was a very good-looking woman. And she had a beautiful voice. I mean, her recording of Butterfly's duet is outstanding. Chi sarà, chi sarà, e come sarà giunto, che dirà, che dirà, chiamerà Butterfly. We, as in Ireland, and the young students, I always tell them that had the voice to sing that repertoire, listen to Margaret Brooke Sheridan. She sang exactly as Puccini wanted. His music is very difficult to follow, and you have to follow what he wants, because he was a great theatrical man for theatre. It's all in the music of Bohème, Annie Tosca, Annie Opera by Puccini.
And she, for you, embodies his intention.
In that, she confirmed that.
When did you actually meet her? You say you walked behind her, walking around the streets of Dublin. You didn't know her.
No, I didn't know her then, no. But I met her when I went to Covent Garden. And when you come to the end of the days, nobody wants you anymore in theatre. You know, because there's a new crowd in, and they're all full of themselves. And then, oh, you must meet the famous Margaret Brooke Sheridan. And I said, who? Oh. 10 years gone since she gave up. And she's forgotten. Because she was so used to walking in the room, and everybody would applaud her. And I could see that on her face, God love her.
You could see that
happening.
Nobody
knew, but there was only the older people were all around her in Covent Garden. And I think when she saw me, bless her, she felt, here they're going to recognise me again.
But let's go back to Rome, because I'm fascinated by this as well. Mm. Now, we've all seen the movie version of this particular man, this Monsignor.
You know who I'm talking about. Monsignor O'Flaherty of the Holy Office.
Gregory Peck.
When it comes down to it, a bullet's your answer to just about everything, isn't it? The only argument you've got.
Tell me how all this happened with you and the Monsignor.
Well, okay, I finished school and I said to my father, I want to go to Rome. That was 1945. And I'd made up my mind, the war's over, I'm going. So before that, when I was in Montambula, I wrote to the nun, the mother house in Milan. And she called me and said, I'm sorry. They said, no, there's nothing there.
So don't go to Milan, because it was after the war.
Yeah, after the war. No, don't
go. It was in a bad state.
Yeah. So that was why this man introduced me to Virginia Murphy. And her husband, as you know, was the Irish ambassador to Rome. So we were at dinner, and she brought along my friend Donny Monsignor O'Flaherty.
Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty. And he was stationed in Rome.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't have been the natural magnet for a singer.
No.
But
yeah,
it was good.
So he said to me, why don't you go to Rome? And when I told him I couldn't go to Milan. So I said, well, would you like to meet my parents? He said, I will. So lo and behold, about the day or two afterwards, he came to my house and Mammy put on a lovely supper for him. But anyway, he said to my father, he said, look, if she comes to Rome, I promise I'll be her guardian. So my father said, right, that's a deal. Now he went back to Rome and I went out in September. And that was 46.
Oggi che magnifica giornata, è giornata di felicità. La mia bella donna se n'è andata.
1946, Rome. I'm trying to imagine what it would be like. And of course, we see movies. It seems like such a romantic kind of notion. Does it live up to that?
It did, because it wasn't touched by the Germans. They left Rome.
They left Rome.
And they left it in peace, let's say.
Was it beautiful to be in Rome?
Oh, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
Vivere senza malinconia.
How many years altogether did you stay there?
4 years, nearly 4 years.
Where did you stay?
I was in the convent up in the Janiculum, but he was in the official office in the Vatican, and he had his own apartment.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to have to go there every Friday and report. And I don't know if it's an old story, really, but there was one bus every hour. And it was like in India, you know, in India, they're on top of it, they're hanging out.
Mm.
I used to get on and get off the other end. And I used to say, I got on a virgin and I got off pregnant. The way they mauled women on the bus, it was unbelievable.
So did you just take to walking after that?
I did.
Spesso la commedia dell'amore, la donna recitar ti fa.
It was very funny, and I wanted to put this on record, that it took me from September to first week in November to find a good teacher. And one in particular I went to in the end was Giuseppe Morelli, who was a conductor. But he wasn't getting anywhere. He wasn't right. And I had to say to Maestro, I'm going home tonight. I have a taxi downstairs and I've got to catch the train. Okay, bye-bye, dear. Thank you very much. Years afterwards, who comes to Dublin? And I'm singing in Amico Fritz, Maestro Giuseppe Morelli.
Wow.
And he was in the pit and he said, tell me, did you ever catch that train? No, Maestro, but you got the message.
So you just wanted out.
I wanted out, yeah. I knew it wasn't right.
I mean, that must have been a bit of a disappointment, that you just couldn't find someone to move you forward from what you'd already learned in Dublin so many years
ago. But I got a wonderful woman, Contessa Caldini Saldani, and she was my age, and she was there, and it was exactly the technique that my Hubert Rooney had.
So, perfect fit.
She's a very good teacher.
Well, I'm sitting in front of one now as well, so you value
clearly not just the great singing, but the great ability to show and to guide. Mm. And but also you're suggesting that even a great teacher might not be the right teacher for somebody if the fit isn't right.
Yeah.
Now, you finally got your debut in Covent Garden, and this is a huge event in any singer's life.
It was. But I was very lucky, you see. When I was there, I had to enter every month to sing, go up to Milan and sing two arias every month to get to the final. Mm-hmm. And I came home then to do a concert in Dublin, and then we went to Sligo. And as I went to Sligo, I didn't know about the competition. I mean, I didn't hear anything since I'd done the last round. And a wire came to my house to say I was needed in Milan the following day. And I had to pack everything, got out to the airport, got on a plane and went to Milan. They had picked four Mimis and you all had to sing one act. And they gave me then the third act. And boy, did I sing my heart out. But that was that. And I didn't know then, until a couple of hours, and they said, yes, you've got it. Then I went back into John Bobberall, who was there, and David Webster. And they heard me and said, well, on the way back, would you call in and sing for Sir John Bobberall? Because he was the artistic director then. And I did.
And how did that go?
He was a very nice man. I think he liked me.
You got to see Maria Callas and you got to meet with her.
Just to get a programme signed. But I met her in Covent Garden.
Subsequently?
Yeah, subsequently.
Well, what was she like as a person?
She was a prima donna, if ever there was a prima donna. She wasn't nice, she was normal, but, you know, it was that much praise from everybody. It's bound to... But I would forgive her for that. But she was very charming.
And explain that to me. I mean, I adore her singing myself because I often tell people in my ignorance, I feel her presence when she sings.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that something worth pursuing as a singer? Did you find that with her?
Well, when I heard her in 47 and I fell in love with her voice, it was unbelievable. She was ginormous.
Grabbed you mostly about her voice?
There was no gears in the voice. It was even from top to bottom. It was wonderful. They had her singing Wagner in Italian, which everybody was annoyed about, but anyway. And she was singing everything.
So that was unusual, wasn't it, that someone could sing quite different aesthetic sort of forms, but do them with aplomb?
Yeah, unbelievable. Took the whole theatre up. I mean, filled the theatre. The sound.
Now, how special was her talent? How unusual was it?
She had a wonderful technique. But I felt very sorry for her when she lost weight.
How so?
Because she lost all what she needed, the energy from her body. to support the wonderful voice.
And was there a way that she could have done that better? Or
well, no, I was 18, size 18, I'm now size 12. I was ailing, I lost all, not a lot of weight. And I find now with me demonstrating, I can't get the voice to do what I wanted to do.
Mm.
How did she feel?
And she was under all that pressure and had to do it.
And I wouldn't compare myself to Maria Callas. Really, I mean, I used to bow to her.
Another one of your greater friends in that arena was Kathleen Ferrier, is that correct?
Oh, Kathleen was. She was special. I never realised she was so ill. In our day, we never talked about cancer. Oh, she's not well. But cancer was never highlighted and it was never discussed.
The word was not even said.
Oh, she's not well. Oh, she hurt herself.
How would you assess her musicality?
She had a haunting voice. I've never heard anybody sing like her. I don't think there's anybody I can hear again like her. Body resonance, and what a face. A very warm, wonderful, joking all the time. But she was the most example to me of how a perfect artist should be.
She exemplified sort of the way to be a great artist.
She's a human being.
Her humility.
Well, you can laugh and joke.
Yes.
And you can take a drink and be part of...
Beyond.
Meet the lowest in this earth and treat them as God. She was just wonderful on the stage, particularly the duet we had. That was in Eurydice. And she was just wonderful. You actually stood back and treated her as God. She was very sincere in her singing. And our technique was 100%.
Because I'm assuming from what you're saying that the opposite was the norm in many cases, that the more successful the artist, the more distant and remote.
Never went to her head like Maria Callas.
So she was quite approachable.
Yeah, yeah. But then, you see, she was ill just after the war.
Mm.
And she died at the wrong time. Don't forget, we have television now, and in my day we hadn't television, you know? The world was big in my day, and it's very small now.
Joan Sutherland is another that you encountered. People run out of things to say about her voice, the size of it, the power of it. And she was also a lovely person, Cardiff.
Joan was gorgeous.
Mm.
She was normal. Let's have a cup of tea if it's in the kitchen. Yeah.
No airs.
No airs or graces. Certainly if she met royalty, I mean, she'd have to behave differently, you know.
What did you think of her voice? What would you...
It was a beautiful voice.
How would you characterise that now?
Well, you can't equal everybody.
No, they're all different, I suppose.
They're all different sounds, or they all happen to you at a different time.
What do you mean by that?
I don't know. We all go through life, and a year could be magical, another year could be normal, another year could be very, very sad.
The sound?
Yeah.
And is that to do
with
the
presence? You meet a person then, you hear them singing, and they would impress you, maybe because of the way you're feeling.
In other words, they might impress you even if they're not impressing themselves.
Yeah.
There's a quality.
Yeah, there's a quality.
That can come out of
I think lots of people, when they go to the concert hall, they all have their day's work in their head. And suddenly one person gets up to sing. And at some stage, they move you. And you don't know why. But it's something that happened to you during the day.
For me, as a listener to that kind of singing, I'm always trying to feel the person, which is unfair, really, because in a sense they have to project the art. You know, I shouldn't be just expecting to feel them.
Yeah.
But in the case, say, of Maria Callas, I always felt that she was allowing me to feel her.
Mm.
She was giving that to her songs.
Mm.
Is that part of the goal that a singer should have, to be able to reveal some of themselves?
Well, I think you'd have to, I mean, a producer would say, I want it done this way. But at the end of the day, okay, the movements are very strict, what they want, okay, fair enough. But I think when it comes to emotion, it's how you feel that what he's telling you, you match it with something and how you felt.
Do you not know for a home in the country, a pretty
You are a mother. You raised a family. You sang on the biggest, most important stages in the world. How did you do all of that?
Well, I look back at them now and I say, how did I do it? I was very fortunate. I had a nanny and a housekeeper here. And I was able to go away. My husband was not the type of man that would take over. He was a businessman, fair dues. And my mother said to me, you can do it now, she said. But when they start going to school, she said, you won't be able to do it. But then I think you accept it. But, you know, if you're put in a spot, you'll manage.
You'll just have to.
You have to.
Did it have, at the end of the day,
an effect on your children, yeah.
And what about on you, on your career? Did it make you make certain decisions?
Well, I had to make certain decisions because it was very difficult being married and with children. And I had to make the decision I'd take up teaching.
A lot of people are very happy that that happened. And your mother was very encouraging too, wasn't she?
She was.
Because they lived long enough to see your success.
They only lived until the late 50s.
Yeah.
Late 50s. But that's when I had to decide. And I did some teaching, and then I was going back and forth to Covent Garden. And up to the 60s, 62, I think I sang in Wexford. Wow. After then, I had to go full-time teaching. And Margaret Bowshan, she was very cross with me when I got married. She was. And she jeered me when I got pregnant.
How so?
Oh, look at you now, she said, you can't do it much anymore.
She had a view on that.
Yeah, a view, absolutely.
How many years are you teaching now? Since the early 60s?
Since the early 62.
That is a phenomenal record in years alone. But then one has to remind oneself that those years are really about the people that meet you, that take knowledge from you and build their own careers. That's a phenomenal amount of people, and I've met some of them myself. Do you still love the contact you have with song through teaching? Do you love imparting that knowledge to people and seeing them grow?
Well, I never thought of teaching, and the last thing I thought of. And one of my first students, Anne Murray.
Belinda,
She had a lovely voice. I mean, it was a natural voice. But at the same time, I think she was always singing. And I suggested to her, Anne, I would advise you, you're in boarding school, to give it up for a year.
So a period of rest would be good?
Would do it, yes. So when she went back to Lanson, and then I was happy. You know, when I was in boarding school, it was only 1 hour a week, but when you're teaching singing, it becomes 3 hours a week, because they're going to forget that each lesson, and it's natural hopping. Because when I went to Italy, I had to go every day for a lesson. It wasn't once or twice a week. You had to go every day, so you never lost the continuity.
Did you ever have vocal fatigue yourself daily routine?
Never did.
Because you had the strength?
Never did. Never that I lost my voice. Never lost my voice.
And in your teaching situation, I assume that people come to you in different phases of their life. For example, Celine Byrne came to you fairly formed.
Yeah.
And other people have come in to you, a much younger sampling, if you wish.
Yeah.
And they require quite a different approach, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I love tenors. I'm very fascinated by tenors. And I have a good technique for tenors. I know I have.
Tell me about that.
Well, you do a lot of chromatic scales with tenors, and you bring them through the falsetto into the true voice. And you keep using falsetto up to a top A flat above top C.
And why do you have a particular fondness for the interaction
with
the tenor?
With the two voices they have, the pure voice, mm-hmm. It's by changing the vowel to a dark vowel, brings them from that falsetto voice into the top voice.
Who do you recall that you loved teaching in that area, the tenor area?
James McCrane, and he comes from RD. Nobody said, well, this guy will never be a tenor, Benny Lovely. And I worked that with him. And he actually has a top E flat in the voice, in his true voice.
How much convincing do you have to do sometimes with
singers? Well, every day.
Are they reluctant to go sometimes?
Every day. Just do it every day, teaching.
So you build on their skills every day. Mm. And do you see them change in front of you then?
Well, they know by their eyes.
You know by their eyes.
It's so easy.
Oh, so they find it easy?
Yeah.
And they're actually feeling a sense of wonder in themselves?
Yeah.
Now, is that satisfying for you when you see that happen in front of you?
Yeah, it's wonderful. Mm. Wonderful.
And I suppose I'm assuming that when you see it on stage then subsequently, if you get a chance to, it must be even greater again. Mm. And I've met one of your students. I heard her singing in the United States one time, and I was quite surprised with her. I hadn't heard a voice like that before, Tara Erocht.
Yeah.
And she had some sort of a relationship with vibrato and so forth that I'd never heard before.
Yeah.
A very different kind of voice.
Yeah.
Now, she came to you when she was quite young.
Yeah.
What did she have then?
She had a good voice. She was a soprano.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought her down to Mezzo. But she was a wonderful student. It was a dream to work with.
Her positivity.
Yeah.
Which is infectious.
Oh, I loved her. Like as your mother and father did, like my own daughter.
And did she have, like, when someone like that comes into you, do you recognise early on, A, what they have, B, what you can make of it?
I don't know. I have a third sense.
A third sense. Does it give you the idea of where you're going to end up?
Yeah.
With a singer?
Mm.
Or is it...
It depends on the... I can hear it. It's up to them to show me.
They have to grow into that picture.
Yeah.
I met Anthony Kearns in the United States also, and he spoke very, very highly of you. But he has also said that he felt that there is quite a rigorous training involved and a determined approach.
Yeah.
And he stayed with you. Mm. You supported him in so many ways, is what he has said. Do you feel always comfortable with hammering home the message?
You have to. Yeah, I also have to tell them that it's a hard, very hard profession and thankless. I mean, we all say to people, you're wonderful. You don't get that afterwards.
You get usually afterwards?
Well, usually what they say, well done tonight, that's all. See you tomorrow at 10 for rehearsal.
It's a bit of a slog.
It's business. Cold business. You're as good as your last performance.
And do you talk to students about that part of the business?
I do.
You do?
You have to. And you have to tell them also that when they start earning money, you put that in the bank, but insurance are invested in property or whatever, because that money is going to deteriorate. And the result is that you live on so much. You don't go out and buy jewellery and dress yourself to the nines. You can't afford that because it's a very short-lived career.
A bit like an athlete.
Yeah.
In that sense.
Absolutely.
So you have a window. If you get the opportunity, save for the rainy day.
But the most important thing is what I told Tara, and I'm telling them all, when you go into an opera studio, you must look at the repertoire, not for that season, the following season, what roles you could sing. And you learn the music. Don't tell anybody. Think ahead. And learn all, have the repertoire ready. Tara rang me up, I told her that. She said, this girl she's arrived. She's not looking too good. What do you think? She said, I said, do you know the role? She said, I practically do. I said, get her off quickly. She said, why? I think she's got pneumonia. And lo and behold, she rang me back. Ronnie, I have a week to get into everything together. Yes, I said, get on that bloody stage, because that's a break. You get one break in life and you got to be ready for it.
And she's been in Munich ever since.
Yeah.
It sounds very hard.
I know it's hard, but you've got to be ready.
My gig is very different because I don't sing in a kind of a company situation.
Yeah.
But it sounds to me, looking in from the outside, it could be perceived as very cutthroat and merciless.
Which is.
So you're basically saying to your students, be ready.
Yeah. Got a standing ovation, and I went over to hear the next performance. I'm sorry I wasn't there, I would have been so proud of her. And then you look at the poster, the very next day they put her in costume on the poster, and it was Tara rocked in Romeo and Juliet. You've got to study everything in with the singer. musicianship is very important. Languages are very important. We lack languages in this country. It's very important. Andy Murphy now was a young fellow in the College of Music, and he went over to the opera studio in Munich, and he did very, very well. And from that, he ended up singing in Karlsruhe Opera House, and he's been singing now in Switzerland, and he's had a great career. You see, Germany has, they have 80 major opera houses. What have we got? Churches to sing in?
Tell me about the singer Miriam Murphy.
I'll tell you about Miriam. On the day I heard her, that was a magnificent instrument. And she studied with me and so forth and so forth and so forth. Then, naturally, she went off to England. The voice was a Rolls Royce, always was, and to this day, it is a Rolls Royce voice.
Can you just unpack that? What makes one voice a Volkswagen and another a Rolls Royce?
Sound.
In what way?
She had the ease. It's like the colours just right for the music. You see, Verdi and Wagner wrote for a bigger body. Cavalleria Rusticana, Pagliacci, Wagner, Verdi. But it was always the big body. And Miriam's body was right, and she could carry it. You see, in those days, you didn't have to move on stage. You stood there and you sang.
You didn't have to actually be able to...
Understand, people were so educated, they only wanted to listen to the music.
Like, even as an audio-only experience, could you tell if someone was too thin but trying to sing the big...
Ah, oh, you can. It's a thinner sound. But look, when you hear a good sound, it's... There's nothing to equal.
My father is a teacher, a retired teacher. My family are teachers. A lot of teachers get jaded. They get tired of the gig,
no,
you know?
No, my God, I live for it. I go in and I have no time to eat at lunch.
Because you just get a buzz.
I love creating. Give me something raw. Not only the voice, how you dress and all that. Everything comes into it. And get them acting.
I assumed walking in incorrectly that... You know, your main target would be the soprano,
yeah,
or the mezzo.
No, you have to accept what they are.
But so you're interested in all of it?
No, all the singers, yeah. I'd one tenor, I'll give you a laugh, he's with me, a very nice fellow, and I won't mention his name. And it's been for quite a few years now, it's getting fine, getting him to come off as tenor, lovely. And he turns to me one day and he said, I think I've had enough from you. He said, I'll move on. And I looked at him and said, fair enough. I said, off you go. I used to be bitter, Rush, but I'm not. I laugh now and say, fair enough. Very hard not to be bitter.
Really?
It is very hard.
You mean that if someone would be...
It's like a stab. Like a stab.
But here's the thing, and this is my final question about teaching in a way. You've had relationships with singers who've gone on, who are now... Some of them have become quite well-esteemed teachers,
yeah,
themselves.
Yeah.
How does that feel for you?
Well, maybe I've endorsed some technique in the brain.
And they're able to pass that on?
Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah.
It must feel good that you have an approach, I would think.
But I got a very good technique from the old school, which is slow, Nothing is quick.
And how many years on average would a student be with you?
Well, I try to get 3 to 4 years.
You need that time.
I need that time. But if you feel them itchy and want to move on, you sort of get the message, you know. They don't have lots of psychology in singing, in teaching.
Giving confidence?
Giving confidence, but also you take the message from them and they get that a bit cocky, you know.
I understand.
And they start teaching you.
Yesterday morning we gave you Springsteen, this morning it's opera.
You established an internationally recognised singing competition in your own name here in Dublin.
Yeah.
Isn't that absolutely gorgeous? And sitting in front of me is the woman who owns that voice. She's Nadine Sierra from Florida, the winner of the 7th Veronica Dunn International Singing Competition. And you are just so good to come into us after and get up.
Is this a culmination for you? Is it a wonderful thing that you can be involved in?
Well, you see, I started first, it was for Irish singers only. And then I had for parents of Irish. And then I said, now we go, we take on the world. You see, we're isolated. This is why we've no opera. It's not around us. And I could see that the young people, they hadn't the money to go abroad and compete in competitions. So I thought I'd bring the competition here. And that's exactly what I've done.
And also, as you suggest there, it brings in and sort of fertilises the ground with people from the international scene.
But I bring people from opera studios. I'm not interested in the intendants and those. I'm not interested in those. I'm interested in the people that are in charge of jobs.
And I see from your jury is they're very illustrious as well.
Yeah, they must go to opera studios. And I think it is made the Irish singer realise that when they do this competition, that they're going to be heard.
So this is a serious, high-quality adjudication.
Yeah.
So it gives singing teachers and singers in Ireland something very real to aim for.
Yeah. And it's opened up for the teachers as well as the students that there's nothing in this country, nor in England, you've only got Covent Garden and Welsh National and Scottish, that there's more in Germany and France. In Germany, you've 80 major opera houses. So you must get a job in one of them.
No, people would have regarded that was a pretty audacious plan to start an international or to move to that.
No.
But no bother.
They look forward to coming over. We've had Tara, I have Niamh Rean, and now I have Sarah Shine going over there. And then the other little girl is going to Switzerland, Sarah Brady. She's going to the Basel.
Funny enough, because we talk to a lot of different kinds of singers, and my favourite ones are the ones who talk about giving something back.
Yeah.
And in essence, this is your mission in the Royal Irish Academy and in the teachers that have followed you. Do you feel that yourself, that giving back is part of the deal?
I'm not. If I have enough money to live, I'm satisfied. I don't want millions. But to me, more important than money, it's giving of yourself, your whole self, to educating another person in singing. There's nothing to equal sitting in the audience and looking at Tara and all the other students I've had. Nothing can come near it.
And tell me one thing. Why is singing important at all?
Well, listen, I suppose at the end of the day, there is a God in heaven, and you have to look and say, thanks to the gift you've given me.
Thank you very, very much, Ronnie. Thank you, Veronica. Thank you. Wonderful.
Leonard was speaking to the singer and vocal coach Veronica Dunn in that the final episode from the current run of the series Vocal Chords. The audio editor was Pierce O'Queeve and the producer was Helen Shaw. The programme is an Athena Media production for RTE Lyric FM.